Economic Development. It's Thursday, February the 13th, 2003. And I was told I'm talking exceptionally fast, so I'll try to slow down a little bit. And for the tap of the gavel, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5011, Department of Consumer and Business Services. Ray, it looks like you're back up here again.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Didn't practice, so I won't go to the last one.
Member of the subcommittee. My name is Greg Malkasian. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services. As with the other mornings, I'd like to review the information that we've provided you. It's a little bit smaller letter today, but it covers quite a bit of information that the committee had requested. Representative Krieger, you had requested some information on building permits fees for Oregon and those of adjacent states, and on attachment one, we provided what we were able to get together yesterday. Interestingly enough, the state of California was on vacation, I think for Lincoln's birthday, and so we had to rely on the internet. We've also provided on the back of that same page a revised submission for Oregon fees. And then I wanted to take just a moment to visit with you about the discussion we had yesterday in the relationship of the Building Codes Division budget, its policy packages, and how they relate to the fee bill. And I thought I could possibly put it in a little clearer context. When Mr. Long was here yesterday, he talked about the management plan of reducing 21.5 FTE to react to the projected shortfall in revenue. And our plan for policy package 191 is to be able to maintain services at that same level, which basically will maintain 9.58 positions. Excuse me. And bottom line, I think it was addressed during the public hearing portion of the fee bill yesterday that the issue is timeliness of services performed. So policy package 191, which restores those 9.58 FTE, is basically to continue the program services at the current level. And then Senator Dukes had requested some information regarding the potential elimination of merit increases and the cost of living allowance and the impact that that would have on the budget and whether or not there were sufficient savings there to justify adding back any personnel. On the second page of the letter, we've outlined how those, in our best estimate at this point, how those merit increase reductions and the inflation reductions would be distributed over the different areas within Building Codes Division. And then after the hearing, Senator Dukes had asked about the potential with the new information about management service personnel over salaries 24 not receiving the February 1 COLA adjustment, what savings that would be, which is $113,000. And as you can see, when it's distributed over the entire organization, Building Codes Division, while it is a savings of about $489,000, when we look at that in comparison to the entire budget of being under 2%, our recommendation would be that because our revenue forecasting is more of an art than a science, and as you have seen over the course of the past several months, the economic projections for Oregon are changing. We think it's better to have that as a safeguard rather than to depend upon that money to provide direct services. And then finally, Senator Morse had requested a copy of our accounts receivable aging information. And Senator Morse, that's provided as attachment 2 to the document. And it has a some initial description of the unique nature of the debt. And we would really enjoy an opportunity to visit with you at some time about that if you have an interest. So that concludes the discussion about the materials that we presented to you for today.
On the second page of your letter there, it says 147 about considering travel and other costs. What part of the 147 is the wages of an electrical inspector, and what are the other costs that you're not talking about?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the $147,000 is wages plus other payroll expenses.
Yes.
And let me see if we have somebody that can tell me the exact payroll cost of that.
$147,000.
Yeah, but without OPE.
Without OPE.
Is that what you asked? Without those other payroll expenses?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, other payroll expenses are 45% of that. And this is for a biennium. It's not. It's for 2 years. And the travel costs are certainly driving to inspection sites and whatnot. Other expenses would be initial setup cost of a person, any additional training costs associated with that person, telecommunication services, a sundry, mainly supply and service type things.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Morris?
Yes, I appreciate that. And I did remember this document. What I was interested in was, with respect specifically to building codes, would you please collections if you have an age analysis of those? This is your global. I'm more just curious if you do have an AR problem with the building codes and the fees.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Morris, the significant portion of our debt problem is the noncompliant employer, and in building codes, you pay for a license or a permit, and so you pay that up front, so we don't lend credit, basically.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
How many of the people that are caught in that thing of employer not providing workers' compensation coverage are people who didn't think they needed to because they thought they had somebody working as an independent contractor, and we came in and said, no, they're an employee? Is that a big percentage of those who are haven't paid? For example, one of my constituents was told that if he shut down his business and left the state, that he would not have to pay like $15,000 worth of fees and charges that were against him. So he did. He just said, terrific, if you don't want me in Oregon, I'll leave. But it was a case where he had a person that was working an independent contractor. The state came in and said, nope, not you owe this amount of money. And I was just wondering if you guys have any handle on what, because I keep hearing that story, you know, hear it on talk shows and this sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, a couple questions there. One, I don't think leaving the state of Oregon absolves you of your debt.
They agreed. What they did is they said, we will, if you were to shut down your business and leave the state, we would not pursue it.
So, Mr. Chair, I believe that certainly agencies have the ability to negotiate settlements, and that may be part of that balance of achieving a safe environment in Oregon. Those kind of decisions, I can't think of any that we've entered into. On the issue of the independent contractor, I will check on this and get back to you if I'm incorrect, but I believe when you register with the Construction Contractors Board, one of the requirements is that if you have employees that you do carry workers' compensation insurance. So it's very clear out front. And when John Schiltz was up the other day, he talked about some of the efforts that they make in the outreach to the community through small business fairs, through interaction with employers to ensure that they are getting the coverage. And there's elements beyond even what the division does, and that's the Small Business Ombudsman, and that he had discussed that at a little, at a certain level. Great. Well, thank you very much. I guess the next presentation would be by Gabe Silva, who is our manager of the Office of Minority Women Emerging Small Business.
Good morning.
Good morning.
morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gabe Silva, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business. You'll find the information about our office in the last tab, pages 1 to 5 of your notebook, under the Minority Women and Emerging Small Business Program. In the 1990s, minority business growth grew by 30% versus 7% growth of all businesses in the country. That's 30% versus 7%. Women-owned businesses currently make up 38% of all U.S. business growth, of all U.S. business. In January of 2003, Washington's Minorities and Business Insider reported a survey conducted by Women Impacting Public Policy. They found that 95% of women business owners in fiscal year 2001 were ready and capable of bidding on federal contracts, but only 2.4% of federal procurement dollars went to those women-owned businesses. So that's 95% versus 2.4% awarded. A report submitted to the U.S. Congress by U.S. General Accounting Office in June 2001, they reported that a Denver survey of 407 business owners found significant differences in loan denial rates for white, African-American, and Hispanic-owned businesses. Another study in Louisiana found that minority firms were almost twice as likely to be rejected for bonding, three times as likely to be rejected for bonding over $1 million, and minority firms were charged higher rates for the same bonding as white firms with the same experience. To make things even worse, evidence has shown that business suppliers withhold price discounts from minority subcontractors, thus driving up contract bids. Concerns about contracting opportunities such as these are the reasons that the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business was established. It was created in 1987, and the governor's advocate position was created at that time as well. In 1993, the office moved under the Department of Consumer and Business Services, where it resides today. You will note our mission on page 2 there of your information, and that is to ensure that minorities, women, and emerging small business have equal access to contracting opportunities in both the public and private sectors. Our purpose is to assist companies in becoming certified and to maintain an Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business Directory used by agencies and contractors that will connect them so that they can be afforded the contracting opportunities. We have three different programs. The first one is a Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program, and those are for recipients of federal transportation-related monies. This is our office's most complex program. Certification program, and it is a federally mandated program that has existed since the late 1970s. Examples of the recipients in this category include the Oregon Department of Transportation, TriMet, and the Port of Portland. Another certification that we have is the Minority and Women Business Enterprises Certification. In 1987, legislators assigned our office the responsibility of certifying these firms to assist local governments such as City of Portland, Multnomah County, Portland Development Commission, Washington County, and others. Also, private corporations are included in that. And the last certification is the Emerging Small Business Certification. And this is a race and gender neutral program created by the 1989 legislature. What we do for business owners is we certify firms that meet the eligibility requirements, and that is very important, meeting the eligibility requirements. We want to make sure that the companies that are bidding for these contracts truly qualify as a minority or women or emerging small business. We maintain our online directory of certified firms, and we coordinate certification awareness activities with the Governor's Advocate's Office. Some of the goals that we have are to complete certifications within 90 days or established guidelines. We continue to look for opportunities in process improvement, such as continually reviewing our rules and policy to make sure that we provide services as quickly as possible. We listen to our customers For example, we recently had one of our small business owners who mentioned that they had two or three of our certifications, and they had to submit a notarized statement every time that they submitted no-change affidavit and the tax forms that went along with that. They recommended that we should coordinate the recertification process so that it's done only once during a year, which is, it makes sense, and we've actually implemented that. We continue to train our staff, and we continue to assist local jurisdictions in their contracting programs and forms. Some of the successes that we've realized, we've learned, we listen to our customers, as I mentioned, in coordinating the certifications. We've established our primary benchmark is timeliness, and we've established key performance measures on a 90-day, 60-day, and 50-day certification period for new applications, depending on the program. We've improved our database to improve processes not only for our staff, but also for information to our small businesses. We now include events on our website so that small business owners are aware of events that are happening that may benefit their company. And we continue with our outreach efforts on how to become certified. Some of the anticipated results for the next biennium is to continue timeliness and effectiveness of our office. Continued certification streamlining with quality certifications. And increased awareness about our online directory and continued outreach efforts, especially to the outer edges of the state of Oregon. You'll notice there in page 3 the different amounts of new applications certified and applications recertified, and you can see that there was a growth in total between the two. Our revenues come from two sources. Approximately half comes from the state agency assessments, and the other half is funded by the Oregon Department of Transportation. Steps taken to control our costs as we are coordinating recertification applications, as I mentioned before, taking advantage of resources in our larger agency. For example, we work with the Workers' Comp Division in discussing some of our appeals, researching information prior to going to the Attorney General's office so that we have our information in a package that then saves time not only for us but for them and reduces legal costs. Steps taken to coordinate related programs. We have a unified certification program agreement, intergovernmental agreement, so that we in fact have a one-stop certification shop. We have joint conferences and community outreach forums, and we have quarterly meetings with the Regional Consortium of Historically Underutilized Businesses. This committee is comprised of representatives from the City of Portland, Multnomah County, Port of Portland, Metro, and others. And we have ongoing meetings with the Governor's Advocate Office and the Oregon Department of Transportation. Our budget request continues our core services, and there are no policy packages. What this buys and provides to Oregon businesses is 1,437 certified minority women and emerging small business firms. Of those 1,437, by the way, some of them have two or three different certifications, totaling 2,179 certifications. A couple months ago, I was at the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, an association in Portland, and I was sitting in a meeting, and as we all introduced ourselves in the large room, a lady was sitting next to me, a business owner in Portland, and she had a flooring company. After I introduced myself, she took the time to tell me that had it not been for the fact that she was certified through our office, she knows she would not have received some of the contracts. Our program continues to certify small businesses, averaging about 1,430 certified firms at any given time. Being certified results in contracting and networking opportunities for minority women and emerging small businesses in Oregon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. And I'm willing and ready to answer any of your questions.
Well, first, Mr. Silva, I think everyone would hear the idea that minorities or women would be treated differently on the loan program, but I was trying to think in my mind what might attribute to it or if it's exact. You mentioned earlier that only 2-some percent of the funds loaned were to minorities and women, one of your first statements.
I was referring to the women.
Yes.
The 2.4%
of the money loaned.
No, they're not loans. They're actually contracted amounts awarded to women and minorities.
What percentage of the applications were from that source? In other words, if it's not the same, if there's less applications, let's say, from women than there were men, the figure would be screwed to look different than what it really is. Is it based on one for one, or is it based on out of the total?
This was a report conducted by the Women Impacting Public Policy, and I would need to gather more information for you to give you the exact answer for that.
I'd like to know that.
Okay.
The other thing, I would suspect maybe certain types of businesses, for instance, fail at a higher rate. Restaurants fail at 90% if you took everybody. But is there a difference? Maybe do women, Hispanics, people of color try to start those kind of businesses at a higher rate? So they're trying to go into a business which is highly competitive and the total failure rate is higher. Do you have anything that would show where those failure rates are within certain types of businesses compared to others?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I'm not sure how to answer your question. Would you please ask me that again as far as what type of information, specific information you're looking for?
Well, if certain types of business that you go into, and restaurants is going up, they fail at 90%. So if you're having minorities or people of color, Hispanic, whatever it might be, women, because that's what we're dealing with here, if that's the type of businesses that they go into or attempt to go into at a higher rate than others, it would show, maybe a reason why they are turned down for loans more. I know we've had several failures in our county from little Hispanic restaurants, and they moved to a different location. Then they were successful 2 years later, same family. I just wondered if there was any way we would know that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, partly to answer your question, the contracts that are awarded are primarily in the construction area, but they are also in professional services related to that. So it's a wide range and scope of contracting opportunities, not just a particular area. So the data that I provided for you is included in that wide range.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Some of the data Representative Krieger showed in the past that institutions were redlining low-income communities. And it's a shame that we've had to deal with for some time. But when we first started this agency, it was due to those kind of issues. Also, the competitiveness at the Department of Transportation and other government entities was not being handled in a way that many minorities' businesses could access. So the issue of access is still a great one in this state, as a matter of fact, in this country. But we have done a little better as a result of this, the Minority and Women in Business Act, and because it also shows that when minorities do well in business, then you have a greater opportunity for other minorities to be hired. And so when you look at what has been going on, now there's a closer relationship with the banking community and certain communities, and so it's much easier to get money. A good instance, for instance, Mr. Chairman, is in Northeast Portland. There was a building that had stood available for about 20 years. Many minorities tried to borrow money to get that business started. And now it's a very successful business, and the money was loaned to a white group of investors. And that same group of black investors, black and Hispanic investors, could not get money to do it. And so we're still dealing with some of those issues in the state. And yes, there is a propensity for many minority businesses to go into business, especially in the restaurant or the restaurateur business, and we know that in about 7-year period of time, which is a mark of basically economic failures in business, and Small Business Administration give you money, but they are not as inclined to go into restaurant business as they are into professional services. And as you can see what is happening in this state, and especially when it relates to lottery and when it relates to other agencies, professional services is going to be the first cut. So, again, those small businesses, especially when you look at Hispanics and, the Latino community and the African-American community, they're going to be very much affected by this economic downturn. And that means that you're going to have a lot of unemployed people. And that's why when I invited you guys to go to the employment division last week, I think 2 weeks ago, was it now? I think it was last week.
Could have been yesterday.
I know.
Last Wednesday.
Yeah, while we were trying to look at the whole issue of access again, because not just with prisoners, but overall, because we have 20 years of double-digit unemployment in Northeast Portland. Even though Portland does well, we mimic rural Oregon in many ways. And so a lot of times that's what we're seeing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a real tough problem to try and solve and try and work with. I worked in the construction industry and in various aspects, including a lot of bid work, for 25 years. There was no question that first you've got the historical patterns of discrimination that occurred through the trades up until probably into the 70s that kept firms out and kept people out. And so that the base of people that actually knew the trades because they'd been denied participation in whole huge industries is tough to overcome. Working in wholesale parts, there was no question that minority contractors, there was a double standard in terms of credit checks, and it was very subtle. It wasn't, there was
never overt.
Yeah, there was never a policy that said we're going to check a person of color's credit 3 times when they walk in the door compared to. And then at Metro and Multnomah County, I was very interested in how both of those agencies contracted. And a lot of the problems would stem from, because of the historical problems, you had smaller businesses that were startups. Well, their capacity to bid on a $15 million contract is pretty weak. But through a lot of hard work trying to figure out how to split off pieces of that contract and make sure that the conditions were fair for the subcontracting. And there were some incredible games that were played amongst the subcontractors using a minority firm prices to get the bid.
That's right.
And then come back and say, yeah, now can you cut your price and knock the profit levels down. I mean, it's been a long, hard struggle, and I don't know, without certification, it's just kind of the basic building block for everything else. Because if you don't have properly certified companies, the number of games that can be played are just incredible. And I don't know, I've always been disappointed by the pace of the progress. But at least it's starting.
Andrew Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. Just so the committee knows, my firm has a contract with the Small Business Development Center, which potentially does work with the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, so I potentially have a conflict of interest. But I do have a couple questions. I'm looking at the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program and that's federally mandated. I'm trying to flow the money. Does the federal government send any money to help implement this certification program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, they provide approximately 44% of our funding for that purpose, for the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program. That's
Transferring
through federal highway dollars coming into the Oregon Department of Transportation.
a follow-up question?
Certainly.
Okay, thank you. That answered one of my questions. Yeah. On the Department of Administrative Services, $655,000, how does that money flow in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I'll probably ask.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that money is through an assessment to all state agencies as part of the I think it's termed the price list.
Thank you.
Gabe, could you provide for us, because there seems to be a lot of interest in that, some of the notes that you had in your opening statement that I think would be very informative for us, or if you have any other information. And the reason I say that, Senator Carter reminded me a little over a year ago, I believe it was in December, we had the Economic Stimulus Committee chaired by Senator Atkinson, and we had a group come in from Portland, particularly women and minority groups that were there, talked about some of the things that they'd faced and dealt with, things they appreciated that were happening on their behalf. But some of the success stories I thought were pretty amazing, but they did talk about some of the things they faced. If you have any of that information, I think it might be good to put in here, so if we will know where to go to refer to some of those statistics that show us what kind of a disadvantage they may face on a kind of a national basis.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I would be glad to do that.
Okay, thanks. Any further questions?
Yes, Representative. Well, I kind of cut myself off before I meant to. The one comment I would make about the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses, I think this is what is right about government. In my business development firm, we've actually done some work, and this is a good service that's being provided, and it really does help create a level playing field and provide opportunities throughout all of Oregon for all folks.
Well, historically, if you look at, you know, the founding documents of this country, the purpose of government was to provide, you know, an equal access, and it's, you know, this I'm with you. I see that this is
Mr. Moore. Yes. One other comment. I hope that you're watching what is happening in the state of Michigan, and that the business community has come together with the university community and has said to the White House that they firmly believe in the stride that they're making in the state of Michigan, and would not want to see the issue of affirmative action not dealt with, because many of the multinational corporations, and they say that for them nationally, even if they don't use people right in their particular state, they have businesses in other parts of the country where people are placed for employment opportunity. And so Oregon, when I came in 1985 with this issue, it has been very near and dear, and we tried to keep it in the governor's office, and it was transferred over to DCBS so that we could watch it. But they've been doing a pretty good job along the lines of trying to develop and design businesses in the state. But my question is, are the agencies doing any better in trying to seek opportunity through you to have more people placed? And the legislature has been notorious, I should tell you. Mm-hmm. For the first time in the history of the state, we just hired an African-American woman in the Department of Human Resources of the legislature. Yes, we just did that. And so a young woman from Northeast Portland. So as you guys, I want to challenge you, as you look around in your offices, to diversify yourself so they can be a good example to the other agencies that you are looking for human worth and helping to develop it. I was guilty. For the first time in my whole life, I bought a granddaughter here who is so smart, and I just hate, I missed even bringing her here before to work in my office. And that's where we're going to have to train people to go into the mainstream of society, and I think a government should certainly be a wonderful example of that. But my question goes back to, is our agencies doing a good job of checking with you guys, trying to find minorities in terms of business opportunity?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, the Advocate's Office would probably have some real good information for you on that, because it is their clearinghouse that matches the contracts with the contractors and the opportunities that exist out there. So they would probably be able to answer that question the best. I can say, however, that we do meet regularly with that regional consortium of historically underutilized businesses, which is the group that includes the Port of Portland, the City of Portland, Multnomah County, TriMet, Metro, and so on. And in those meetings, we do discuss certification, And to me, it's obvious that they are trying to increase those percentages.
Okay, one question I had, first of all, I noticed that big number coming in from ODOT, and then the 44% of it coming, from federal programs that says you will try to do this. The question is, how are they doing out in ODOT? I mean, that would be a classic place where you could think of a lot of things that you might be able to bring a small contractor in and get things that they could do with certain maintenance type things, from landscaping to a major maintenance operation. Do they track how their success is? Maybe that's something we'll ask them when they get here.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would say that would be the best source, is the information directly from them, because I know that they have a 10% goal, for example, and whether or not they're meeting that goal, they would be able to answer that question for you.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The transfer out to the governor's office, could you elaborate what that involves on your revenues and disbursements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, that transfer out, I believe, is for the costs associated with that advocate that Gabe was referring to, that is in the governor's office, Lydia Munoz, that her office of advocacy is located in the governor's office.
I'm
just looking.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I think this is probably a trite old phrase, but my mother used to say all the time, if you want to know how the horse feels, go to the horse's mouth. And I would like to indulge, if you will, in bringing a panel of minority businesses before this committee, with your permission. And then we could know the status of how they're doing.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that you could do that also in the context of the Economic Development Department,
right?
Because they also have a minority and women outreach effort. So I think that we could accommodate that within the hearings that we're having for that agency.
And there may be an opportunity, if everyone would look under the schedule, we have agenda for next week. And Rob and I were talking earlier, you might discuss that. We think that we may have some time in there. Next week.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if we get done with the budget overview today, I was hoping that we would spend Monday doing some discussion among the committee members of how what their feeling is on some of the standard issues that the committee is going to need to decide once and when we have committee rules, such as the performance measures and the standard reductions that we are looking at. But I'm assuming that could be wrapped up on Monday easily, which would free up Tuesday if that's the wish of the committee.
Senator, would you like to try to put that
I would together? Love to do that.
I think that would be very informative, mm-hmm. because I really appreciated when they came in and chased
right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Adding to the conversation, I would hope that we would also include the small business development centers, and as we go through their budget, hold their feet to the fire and ask them what they're doing to reach out to the folks that we're talking about, and it'll go a long ways towards helping answer Representative Krieger's question about the success rates, because I do know the SBDC's in some areas are doing a very good job, and in other areas they could improve. So,
okay. We'll tentatively plan for that then for Tuesday.
That would be wonderful, Mr. Chairman, because one of the most wonderful men that has taken the total position that has fought very hard when we first started putting small business development centers on through our Committee on Trade Economic Development is Sandy Cutler, who is going to retire this year. And so it would just be nice to have him to have his swan song before this committee so we can give him kudos for his work.
Okay. I hate to interrupt one last time. I do have one more question, actually. Thank you, Chair George. On the interest income, $42,000, what's that interest income being derived off of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that would be the ending balance or the ongoing balance in the account, that the interest income from that. You see at the top there's a beginning balance of $359,000, and then there's revenue inflows and outflows, and while that revenue is in a holding account or a savings account, it's earning interest, and that interest is used, obviously, to offset the cost of the...
What was your calculation to come up with $42,000? My background's commercial finance. That seems extraordinarily high on an inflow of $1.5 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I think we can get you the exact calculation, but knowing that the balance is not static, obviously, because you have revenues coming in at different times, and then your demand for those revenues to pay for the cost of the program also happen at other times, it's an ongoing changing balance, and whatever that balance is, it is earning interest through the, I think, the Oregon Savings Plan, right? The Treasurer's Office, and they manage those funds in a way to obviously maximize the earnings.
So if we took 40 follow up question, mm-hmm. So you had $42,000, you divide that by 2 for the biennium, so we're at 21. What's the average balance then? Annual balance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, could we get you that information? I don't have that actual information, but we can certainly get that for you.
Please, because as I run that number through my head, you take 42 divided by 2, that's 21. On $1 million, even if that's high running balance, that's a very high interest rate that you'd be anticipating to get that type of return.
Greg, if you
we'll
could,
certainly get that for you.
If you could, because that's come up several times already in the committee, and what I'd like to know is if you could kind of give us if you have any of the other accounts that show balances like that with relatively high interest income, show us what kind of yields the Treasurer is actually getting for it. I think that might be very informative for us there.
Mr. Chair, certainly we'll do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any further questions? All right. We thank you so much. It looks like we found you and to be here probably on Tuesday.
If Tuesday, Mr. Chair, if Tuesday we're going to have that,
right.
The hearing, Monday would be to wrap up any.
Oh, I know, but I assumed he would want to be here with.
Oh, them.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that would be strange.
Okay.
Central support.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Greg Malcasian, and today I'd like to visit with you a little bit about our central support services portion of the budget. And there is a tab that's titled a little bit before where you were, Central Support Services. And the first page is the organization chart. And basically, the central support service exists to add value to the divisions that you've heard from over the course of the last 5 days. As Corey Streisinger discussed last Thursday, they provide the leadership and the central direction to the agency, plus several other things like business functions, communications, information technology, and personnel functions. At the bottom of the organization chart, you see two boxes, and they are two other service offices, the Ombudsman for Injured Workers and the Small Business Ombudsman. And we had talked earlier about them. I think John Schultz, on the day he presented Workers' Compensation Division, talked about how the Ombudsman for Injured Workers provides services and is an advocate for injured workers. And we even met with Representative Krieger, and we're hoping to meet with other legislators as time is available. And then John also mentioned the role that the Small Business Ombudsman plays in providing services to small businesses. And it kind of, that was in reference to one of your questions, Senator George, about the construction contractors and how the small business ombudsman assures that there is available workers' compensation insurance as well as dealing with other small business issues.
It would be so much easier if we just moved the CCB over to the CBS. Maybe before I get out of this building. The president had one last session.
No, we didn't get it out, so.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, since these ombudsman roles are advocacy roles and not regulatory in nature, it's important that they are independent and they report directly to the director. That provides the director the ability to have an understanding for the balance in the system that we also talked about during the workers' compensation system discussion. There are basically two key messages that I hope to get across to you today, and that is that Central Support Services provides a pool of technical experts who can respond quickly to priority projects, and then that there are efficiencies gained through economies of scale. As Corey discussed in the first day of testimony before the committee, she went over page 20 of the agency overview and showed how the agency has grown and changed in its complexity. And this type of ability to have the flexibility to respond to necessary services is a significant added value through centralization. It provides a central point of accountability, and it also allows us to meet those changing demands. And I hope that you've seen this week our ability to roll up data on an agency-wide basis and our ability to respond to the questions and hopefully the next morning be able to provide you important information that you need to make your decisions.
Senator Dukes.
Mm-hmm. I'm struggling here because I hit the bottom of the page first, and that I wish I hadn't done that. And I'm just... As you're making your presentation, can you help me? I was shocked. 192 positions and $35 million in this one section? You'll help me not be shocked as you go through this, right? I was amazed. I mean, I believe in central services.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I think that what's different about the Department of Consumer and Business Services in relationship to how we are organized is that many agencies obviously integrate certain activities within the division, their agencies themselves, obviously. They're very integrated. And we attempt to provide that same level of integration or in service delivery, but from an organizational perspective, we try to have these activities like information management systems, which is a significant activity, separated out so that while there are specific support requirements that are given to each of the divisions, that the actual personnel and the services are located in this specific area. Does that help?
Not much. I'll try. I mean, it's like most agencies that deal with computer things, we send them to DAS, and we've been trying to get a handle on that. So I was surprised to find out that DCBS handled all of, well, it looks like most of it anyway, internally. So I just keep talking, but bear in mind that I'm stumbling pretty bad over that big
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to help you understand where those dollars are spent, if you turn to their page 9, they do break out what the components are of that that dollar amount. And as you can see, the Information Management Division budget is a very big chunk of that $35 million, just FYI.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, if I could just add just a little bit, and hopefully then we can discuss it more if there's value there. Certainly, our efforts on information management are done with an enterprise perspective, and we are working very closely with the Information Resource Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services to ensure that any of our efforts are complementary to and supportive of their centralized interests. You know, And we sit on the Information Technology Executive Committee to assure that that happens and that coordination takes place. Our administrator of the Information Management Division sits on the Chief Information Officer Council, which is a sub-element group of that Information Technology Executive Committee. So we have a very strong interest in looking at this from an enterprise perspective for the whole state to assure that we are coordinated and where there is a good business case for supporting centralized services, that we too are aligned to that. And kind of along the lines of what Robin was talking about is how those numbers are allocated to the divisions. We actually have a chargeback plan that allocates central services to the divisions, and it's designed to support the legislative intent that each program be self-supporting, and the dedicated revenue is only used for the purpose for which it was collected. I'd like to touch on some of the major accomplishments on...
Schwartz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, it's just a comment. One of the things that we're doing is looking at the cost per FTE where you don't have any transfers out. It's for the cost centers. And it's interesting. It ranges from $120,000 per FTE for biennium. This happens to be $183,637. We have some cost centers that are well over $200,000 per FTE per biennium. So, and I'd be happy to share those spreadsheets with the committee if there was interest in looking at that.
Well, Greg, relative to that, let me tag on to that, and I'll make it into a question. Is when we were looking at the minority women emerging small business portion, the transfer out of the governor's office, if I understood Gabe correctly, that was one person in the governor's office costing $424,000.
Mr. Chair, there are two people in that office, and that's for a biennium and then all the associated. Yes.
Okay. Well, I wrote one. I will change it to two.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Couple questions and a comment. Clearly, there's concern in terms of the transfer from the building, the transfer to central support services from the building trades in relation to the building codes division. A couple questions about one on my book on central support, page 9. There's no dollar figure listed for beginning balance. Is that a typo in my?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, this is one of the interesting things about the organization that is very different. We don't have a fund that supports central services support. It's actually funded through those charges to the division. So there is no fund balance. It's allocated out to the different divisions. There may be a minor balance shown at the end, but it's just, I believe, basically associated with... Okay, it's based upon the anticipated cost of living increases that won't occur, so you'll see that go away.
Okay, the whole $1.9 million will go away?
Yes.
Okay, that was my concern, that because of the way the budget is structured with each division carrying an ending balance, why would you need an ending balance in central support? But you're not going to have one, so that settles that. The other thing is just I'm concerned when we see an increase of FTE, and usually FTE don't bother me a whole lot in terms of if you've got tasks to do and you need to get them done, you have to have people to do them. But we're having 21 position decrease in building codes. which is a significant decrease. And then in central support, we're increasing by 4 positions. Theoretically, if you downsize, you downsize in one place to balance out that. And I don't see any, a couple new positions in the Office of Personnel Services. I don't see anything extraordinary in terms of your goals and your anticipated results that aren't a special activity that wouldn't be just considered normal doing business by a personnel department. You know, you've got some succession plans and some things that are pretty much common what a good personnel agency would do or a personnel department would do. So I think I'll really need to see some justification for increasing central support positions at a time when we're cutting back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we can get you information regarding that.
Senator Dukes. And I'm probably going even further. I'm looking at your prioritized list, and I'm noticing that employee training and safety and risk management are prioritized lower than leadership and communication services. That troubles me. I can work with Senator Morris and others, and we'll probably have a conversation about some of these. I mean, this looks like the old days at ODOT, quite honestly. And it took how many sessions to get past some of that? Mm-hmm. But we got there, more or less. You've got fees coming in to pay for all of this, and you've got agencies that you can assess. But part of the spiraling cost we deal with in other agencies' budgets is this sort of thing. There's nothing they can do about it because it just is there unless we get part of what's causing these assessments. There's nothing that will change. So I'd be willing to sacrifice some of your external public relations in order to get the costs down. Not all of them, mind you, because I want you to get your message out. But especially if it meant we could do more employee training, which meant they could actually work with the public in a better manner.
Senator Morris. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In light of the comments that have been made with respect to downsizing, have you, within your department, looked at a worst-case kind of operational scenario and how that budget might play itself out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we have discussed that with Robin and had some consideration and provided some materials for Robin for consideration. And the prioritized list is one aspect of it. I realize this particular list is a little bit disconcerting, and it was to us. Our challenge here was central support.
The prioritized list was disconcerting to you? Who made it up?
Well, no. Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, maybe that wasn't a good use of terms, but we were very challenged on how we prioritize central services since they are so directly required for the operations of each of the divisions. And so one of our challenges was we really needed to know what decisions that you would make with respect to the divisions before we could really go to central services and see what the required support for the divisions would be. And that's why we have them kind of separated out. We want to do this in a very careful and thoughtful way. And so we needed to have the information from you before we really made a recommendation to you on where we should cut in central services.
Can you have another question?
As a matter of process looking forward, when we get to the point that we have rules so we can make decisions, will we be asking the departments to make their recommendations with respect to how they would do the downsizing?
Well, that's an important question, and you raised it in full Ways and Means about what about if it's not 14%, but it's 10, 5, or 0.
Right.
And I'm hoping everyone is thinking in those kind of terms, you know, a scenario of what happens if.
But I know that you haven't been asked to do that. But.
Yes, we have in terms of the general fund supported agencies.
Right.
This is an other fund agencies, which is not to say that that scrutiny isn't totally appropriate, but we would. I'm going to need direction from the committee in terms of where they would like me to go in terms of what they think is the approach to this budget, and then we will need to have a conversation with the agency as to the impact of those reductions if they occur on the agency, the programs, the stakeholders, all of those areas that are affected. So with other fund agencies, it's a little bit different, and it is really a sense of what the committee feels is the appropriate approach to take on an agency-by-agency basis.
Rob, let me just describe it this way. We just went through two of the worst years I've ever experienced, and we just got some really bad news the day before yesterday. And so there's no indication that the downturn in the economy, you may not continue down. That'll mean that everyone who's paying you fees may not. And so, my thought is that if you're a pessimist and anticipating, what it might work out and what it might be the end result, you're very happy when it's much better than that. But at least you have anticipated and have a plan as to what would happen. But relative to that, I am troubled by the information management division, and if you could give me some clarification on this. I can remember when I was back on a budget committee for the county, and we were first bringing all the computer technologies, and one of the things that we were told was eventually this stuff will save us so much time that we will eliminate these departments, and yet here we are, we're going from 82 to 85 positions, and so help me understand. I mean, what things are you bringing in? What requirements are being placed on them? I know the collection interpretation analysis part may be a major portion of that. But, something like that, I would like to get my hands around that.
Mr. Chair, members, I would like to see the agency bring forward the report that they made to the IMT committee.
Mm-hmm.
They have a number of initiatives that they are working on, and I think it would be helpful if they must have anticipated. I did not talk about this.
In the book.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Getting back to that, think back when you used to wipe or go into a motel in a minute and a half, walk out the door, check in, now do it with a computer, it takes 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's right.
Crazy. And then you get that little thing on the door that doesn't work, and every other time you got to go back to the counter and get it fixed. It costs more money. Give me an old pencil and a card, and I can get it done.
The towels are so fluffy, you can't get your suitcase full.
Greg, do you have copies that we could make of that, or of the presentation to the IMT committee, or could you bring it on Monday?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Lamont, yes, we can certainly provide the overview letter, and I can review some of the information here if it would be helpful to the committee, whatever they desire.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It occurred to me as I'm sitting here that those electrical fees that we were concerned about raising yesterday might have something to do with $35 million in central services. So, we think we can keep asking, and the folks out there are saying, yeah, we'll pay it because we need the services. But I think it's worth taking a look at.
Certainly. I would like to touch on a few of the major accomplishments tonight, and we have some of them listed on page 3 and 4 of the presentation material. I think that it might be helpful to kind of focus on some of the these cost drivers that we're discussing here today, and especially with respect to information management technology. We've made significant efforts there in response to trying to provide services to our customers, and a lot of these are supportive of the initiatives that Ms. Streisinger discussed on the first day of testimony around regulatory streamlining. One of those areas is electronic data interchange, and then also electronic government initiatives to better serve our customers. And in the area of electronic data interchange, I think you may remember Joel talked about our ability now to issue an agent license over the internet that before was not available. An agent had to go to each state, but now it's through a clearinghouse approach through the NAIC. Another area that we provided increased support to our customers through electronic data interchange, and we are continuing to refine this, is in the actual submission of workers' compensation proof of coverage to the agency to be able to receive that electronically rather than manage it through a paper system. In the area of electronic government, now mortgage lenders are able to register for their licenses online. And our next step in this is we're working with the Information Resource Management Division to achieve the ability to receive the payment online for them as well as for other customers within our agency. The day that Mr. DeLuca spoke about Oregon OSHA, he talked about the OSHA Film Library, the Resource Center, and that is something that we developed as an online application so people can see what is available, order it, identify the time that it's available, and have it actually sent out to them so that they can provide the safety information to their employees. Other accomplishments certainly are what we had discussed earlier about focusing the agency's executive team on our mission of customer service is one of the areas providing being sure that we are providing services to the customers of our agency, and we have seen that as a common theme throughout the discussions with all of the divisions that have come before you. We're basically using a two-pronged approach in that customer service initiative, and it's to hire the right people in the first place and to continue to set expectations for those people that are currently employed with us. And as Senator Duke said, training is an important element to that. Ms. Dreisinger discussed the regulatory streamlining earlier, so I won't go into that. We also have an initiative that will look at our revenue structure to identify ways to address the costs of collecting fees, to do that more efficiently, to simplify a relatively complex financial management system, and hopefully streamline fee structures. These are the things that we're hoping to be doing. Bottom line, our budget request is for no new positions and no packages. And that completes my testimony.
Mr. Chair. Okay, now I'm confused. No new positions, but at the bottom of that first page, it has 01. Now, maybe that's because that's the approved 0103 and not special session 5, post 103. I don't know. But this is 188 positions, and it says requested for 0305 is 192 positions. What am I missing?
Mr. Chair, if I may. Mr. Chair, these positions were established in administrative action. Sometimes agencies establish positions for permanent financing. And it could also be, now I need to look at the details, but it could be the phase-in of some positions that were approved for a portion of the biennium. So I would need to look at the details and get back to you.
Just say that maybe they created some of their own positions during the last interim.
I mean, what happens is sometimes if a position was approved last biennium for just a portion of this biennium, then for next biennium we need that for 24 months. So biennializing that, but I would need to look at the details and I'll get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, there is also, it might be helpful, is our divisions came before you I think it was the last legislative session, and requested in the division budgets increased support for information management systems for those personnel. And so those personnel were approved in the budget of those divisions, but then they were ultimately transferred to where we provide those services, which is information management division. And so that's another reason for part of that.
I just would have thought they'd show up in the approved budget from 0103, but maybe not.
Yes.
I think your question was right, Senator, whether it's the 0103 regular session or the special,
special session.
Yeah,
although that may not.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they did not have adjustments in special session because they are other funds, with the exception of the salary adjustment that was granted.
Chair, can I ask?
Certainly. I have a request. I'm on page 3, and I'm looking through the successes for 0103. And I'm going to ask that for some of these things that you put FTE numbers with them, I'd like to know how many FTE there are in the department's executive team, and how many people... How many FTE were related to expanding the agency-wide emergency preparedness and response system? And I'd like some explanation of why you self-audit. Generally speaking, we look to outside audits for whether or not you're doing a good job in human resource management and those kinds of things. And I see that you conduct your own audits to improve performance, internal controls, and information security, and your own audits to design and implement human resource management stuff. So if I can get an FTE.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke certainly will provide you that information.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I was looking at the overall budget of the agency, Senator Duke, and if you look at the overall budget, you will see a reduction of 6 positions and 3.84 FTE. So, my thing is, maybe there was a shifting of FTE from some divisions to some support. That's why under this division you see an increase, but some other divisions
okay.
A decrease. Like, for example, workers' compensation board, there's a reduction of 2 FTE, and workers' compensation division is 1.46 FTE, so
okay,
it could be a
shifted.
But
right.
We will double check that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope everyone will understand this and bear with me because, you know, I am a farmer. But
yeah, right.
One of the this is for Robin and Sabine, and that is, you know, last session when we were looking at, we thought 3,500 FTE that had not positions that hadn't been filled, only to find out that really what those were was kind of like a slush fund. Have there been any efforts to tighten those things up to where we know that we're talking about actually hiring people? And that it has not some sort of reserve fund in this current biennium process.
Yes, Mr. Chair, but what I will ask when we get ready to go into work session is that the agency come forward with their most recent vacancy list and justify what positions on that list should be filled. I intend to treat DCBS exactly like any other agency and have them do that justification, but I don't believe we can do it until we've got a work session.
Right. Well, that was just kind of a philosophical question, whether we're approaching this on a more business-like basis. Because
I have, Mr. Chair, members, I have looked at their current vacancy list.
Okay.
They do not appear at this point to have a lot of vacancies that are just sitting there.
And that was not directed at this agency, but
right.
in just general to everyone we're going to face it. That was very disturbing to, you know, have 3,500, actually 4,000 originally, and then down to 35 in the third special session. Just have it disappear, vaporize. It wasn't there. And so I think that was real good that we're tightening that up. This is the time to do it.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do that any biennium anyway,
okay.
So as the agency can attest to. But we will do a walkthrough when it comes time for work session.
Senator Carter.
I was just going to say, I've been knowing Robin all these years I've been here. She does not play, so we will not have any padded positions.
Well, I hope not.
We're looking for bodies. She finds them.
Okay.
We would like to thank you for the time that you've spent to provide information to us and to listen to our programs throughout the course of the week, and it's been a pleasure to be before you. Thank you.
Well, we thank you, too, for getting back with such detailed answers to questions asked by the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I think all this agency and apology, we just have 50-odd committees, and I'm working on so many task force, Mr. Chairman, I have to publicly ask your forgiveness, too, because that's what's going on.
Okay. But you are going to work on Tuesday's meeting.
I am going to work on Tuesday's meeting.
That's Senator right. Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just by our very nature, we have to be inquisitive and ask questions that may appear to be criticisms, but I need to let you know a positive that I heard when I was asking about the fee increase in the building codes division, and very, very positive comments from your clients with respect to the performance of that division, and very supportive. So I need to pass that on as a attaboy, not a girl, that you know, you need to hear those things too. So.
Thank you very much for the feedback.
Well, Greg, relative to my question about the, you know, the issue of the information management, there's no question that these things are desired by clients and that they have to occur. But I hope you're thinking about someday we get a handle on this and start bringing these numbers down, because that was the promise when we entered into technology, that, you know, we would beat a piece of paper and a pencil, you know. And so hopefully we get there someday. Any further questions or comments?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask the committee, if Monday we are going to have sort of a discussion about this budget, if there are issues that any of the members would like me to focus in on, if you could get to me before Monday so that I can be prepared to, you know, and work with the agency to see that we get the information that you need, that would be very helpful.
Yes, Senator Carter, then Senator Morris.
Just not on this agency. Are we through? I'm just going to ask him.
Oh, no. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask if there's anyone. We talked about a possibility of a public hearing.
I put that on there, Mr. Chair.
And I was going to ask if there was anyone out here. That,
right, just on the off chance that there was something that came up that required us to open a public hearing. So
I saw some new faces come in, so I was just curious. Okay, then I think we're about there.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, now when do we hear lottery?
Hang on, I think I do have
this. I have a general question around the nine is, I want to know, when agencies come to talk about external audits, the cost of those audits, and I especially is blowing to me, is the nearly $1 million cost for an external audit for lottery.
If we stay on schedule, Mr. Chair, it looks to me like the week of March 3rd, sort of midweek, we will have a presentation from the Lottery Commission.
Okay.
So that would be a good time to ask that question.
Yeah, that's a lot of money, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Could we alert them in advance?
I will do that.
Okay. It was a lot.
Senator Morris?
Mr. Chair, a question for Robin. I don't want to fall into a trap in trying to understand across the board all of the departments that we're looking at in Ways and Means. And am I falling into a trap if I look at the total, excluding any transfers out where the agency is actually taking in more revenue and distributing it to the general fund, but just trying to look at a discrete cost center and multiplying that total cost, or dividing the total cost by the FTE, because we are all over the board. And then that raises the question of, well, the aviation was 120,000, I think, 16 FTEs, mm-hmm. take their budget. I mean, they have a discrete cost center. And then this is 187,000. Some of these boards and commissions that we're looking at are well over 200,000. And can you help me a little bit in this?
It tells you What that calculation generally tells you is a couple of things, but primarily what it indicates is the professional level of the people within the program that you're calculating. A heavily clerical program, for example, will have a much lower cost per FTE than one where most of the staff are professional. So that it you know, but I think it is a good way of getting the agency to explain to you how they do their work. I mean, so I think, for example, if you've done that calculation for the divisions within DCVS, I think that's a good conversation to have. I think it will help you to understand what the mix of people and classifications and other expenses that occur with it. You know, the other thing that you may be running into also is an agency that has a very high level of special payments. You may end up seeing an extraordinarily high cost per FTE because of dollars going out the door. But that conversation will help you to understand those dynamics. So as long as you understand it's a way of understanding the program, not necessarily a problem. It maybe is. I don't know. But, no, I don't think you're going down the wrong path. I think it's a way of getting a handle on what the dynamics are within a program.
Thank you. If there is nothing further, then with the tap of the gavel, I'll close the hearing on House Bill 5011, and we will be adjourned.
Until Monday.
Yeah, Monday. Yes. Right. Thank you. That's right.